The following talk was given by Steve Hagen on December 8th, 2024.
Well, good morning, everybody. Good to see you. It's nice to be here. I'm a little familiar with Unitarian churches. My oldest brother was a Unitarian, and I've spoken several times at Unitarian churches before. I've always found you to be a good group of people, interesting to talk to. Very open and interested in many things. So it's good to be here. There's a distinction between my other brother. He was a Lutheran minister, but I went a different way. Our poor mother, she probably couldn't figure out, especially when I came home. Anyway, but good to be here. The topic I was given for today was presence. I see on the schedule there, it's the practice of presence, yeah. Very well put. The teaching that I do and what I live out is generally a practice. We look at it that way. But this term presence, I've been studying and practicing Zen Buddhism now for over 50 years and never really encountered this term, presence, so much. And so when I was asked to come and speak on this, I thought, well, I don't know if I have anything to say. So I was contemplating maybe I should turn it down. On the other hand, I thought about it a little bit and I realized that, well, maybe the very fact that we don't use this term generally, it's not like it never comes up, but I could say something about that. And it has to do with a very profound teaching of the Buddha, who I think perhaps many of you may have heard of this teaching of anatta, the teaching of not self. So this is coming from a very unusual perspective for most of us. In fact, most of the time when we encounter this teaching, and I first encountered it through my Unitarian brother. He was in college. He was quite a bit older than me. I was just a kid. But he first introduced me to Buddhist ideas, which for me, I guess it kind of stuck. And he was intrigued by this and found it difficult to understand this teaching of not self. And I remember myself as probably an 8-year-old or so, I was also puzzled by that. And I've known over the course of my adult years when I started studying Buddhism, practicing it, this is pretty common among people. It's not easy to understand. But if we don't, as I said, we don't use this term presence. But if we did, well, let's put it this way, maybe the reason that we don't speak in those terms so much is because this is all presence. There's no non-presence. It's only presence. But I'll say a little bit more about this anatta, this non-self, and all non-being, we could say. But again, it's quite difficult. It took me years of approaching this before I finally began to realize what this teaching was at its heart. But starting with how we normally use this term or think of this term, presence kind of indicates being, or maybe it assumes being, or it assumes perhaps self, and then other as well. But behind it is this assumption of thingness, that there's something there. Could be myself that is here, we would say. But again, there's non-presence. So it's only here and now. That's that we don't find presence in past or future. It's just here now. So it becomes very singular in a way. So there's just presence. And we can't leave it. Though we think we do, when we speak of it then as, well, I am present or I want to be present, well, what are we talking about? We want to have our mind here. You know, we talk about presence of mind as well, that we can remain cool and rational under very trying circumstances or something like this. We bring our mind here. But that is our conscious mind, I often call it our grasping mind. The mind is holding, that is holding something, or that can hold something, thoughts, ideas. but also objects of various kind, including people, who we don't necessarily, we probably don't want to think of people as objects, but it was something objective, something out there and separate and apart from me. We think in these terms, and it seems like we can leave the immediate vicinity of where we are through our mind, where our mind wanders away. We're not really here. I'm a Zen practitioner, Zen teacher. Zen means meditation. This meditation that we do is just simply that is to bring ourselves back to right here, right now, which of course we've never left. We never leave here and now. But in our minds, it seems like we can. And so maybe we want to make ourselves present, bring ourselves back. But we're always present. It is always here, but it could be present is this wandering mind that isn't engaged in the immediate surroundings that we find ourselves in, or something like this. And so the mind might seem like it's scattered or wandering about, but our practice then is just simply to notice this. And in that very noticing of this, we're already back right here. But we don't say, we don't mark it as presence or something like that. I mean, we could, I suppose. But often we talk about presence in a way in our just our common everyday looking at this, or assuming that here I am in a world of others, in the world of things and comings and goings. We talk about, and we can attribute this quality of presence maybe to certain people, to some people, who when they say step into a room, just command the room, you know, they have an imposing presence or something that they bring to whatever it might be. And we might talk in this way, but we can also, we also talk in a way of where we maybe enter a room and then we feel a kind of presence in this room of some kind, you know. And we feel that, maybe it's a room that we knew, a room we come back to, a place where we used to play with our friends when we were children. And we feel a certain kind of presence in this room when we come back to such a, or say a room where maybe a friend died or something like this. And we can easily step into such a space and we say that we feel a presence there in this space. And that's how we might commonly talk about this. But what's important from a Buddhist standpoint or from a Zen perspective here is that all the while, no matter how we view this or think of it or see it subjectively as myself, and I want to be present here in whatever's taking place, no matter how we view this, it is always mental. It is a mental activity, not a physical one. You thought, might think, well, yes, but if I'm present, and I'm talking about myself being physically present in this room or something like that. Yeah, we use the term in that way. But the teaching of the awakened is such that the awakened people like Gautama on this date so many years ago, 2.5 millennia ago, he awoke to the real circumstance of life, the actual situation that we find ourselves in here. So you can say that maybe he had gained some kind of presence here. But what we awaken to is that this is always presence. We are always here. It is always now. It is never then. It is never, you know, somewhere off in the future or the past. We can't be present in such places as that, and we aren't. We never are. It is always here. If here involves a memory, or a, you know, or even just maybe a story of past events, maybe long before we were ever born, maybe, or times off in the future that, again, are not here, we can maybe think of presence then. We might project it in some way and think that, yes, but I was here. and at that time, or whatever it might be. But that is always mental. That is a thought. That is an idea. That's a memory. That is all taking place in mind space, we could say. Not in physical space. In physical space, there is only now. But even now, we actually don't, the foundations of this reality, of this very moment now, these two are not actually physical. Even though you say, well, physically I am here, you're here in this room, which is physical, material, surrounding us, that sort of thing. Yes, but if we look very carefully at actual immediate direct experience, it is always of mind. Today, there's a lot of people looking at consciousness, and they use the term consciousness quite a bit. And every experience we've ever had is a conscious experience, we would say. There's no such thing as a non-conscious experience. It is always conscious. So this is, again, I was saying we can use presence in this very same way. But the problem that we have, this is what the Buddha recognized, and this is where our suffering comes from. You've indicated that Buddha sat down under this tree to finally resolve this problem of suffering. And what exactly is that? Well, what he came to realize is that it isn't that it comes from, it is our very assumption of thingness, of being something, and of persisting through time as, say, myself, or this podium here, or the microphone, or any number of things that we see, or other people. We see it all in terms of being, in terms of time, in terms of persistence. And if you look very carefully, whenever we talk about existence, you know, that I exist, this room exists, you exist. if you look very carefully, what do you mean in your mind by that term, existence? I think if you stayed with it a while, I don't expect you to just, oh yeah, I get it right now. But if you reflect on it and come back to this, and it might even take a few years, but come back to and look at, what are you assuming here that's existing? What the Buddha realizes is that we don't have anything that is existing. Or if I change the word to persisting, then maybe you can kind of see where he's coming from there with that. But there is nothing within the experience that is persisting, including me, the subject, let alone all the objects of various kinds that we might find within this experience. It is all changing. It is all coming and going. There's no substantiality behind any of it. This term I'm using is substantiality. In Sanskrit, it's shunyata. It's a word that one of the great Buddhist teachers, Nagarjuna, used in pointing out that it is all, we translate it generally as emptiness, that it is all empty. And then often it gets translated as nothingness, something like that, which is not at all what the Buddha taught or what he said. This is why we don't talk about no self. The Buddha never said no self. What he said was not self. Meaning that anything you pick up, whether it's a physical thing of some sort, or a thought, or a feeling, an idea, an understanding, and if you ask yourself this, when the Buddha asks you, is this self? And it isn't. And why isn't it? Because there isn't anything you can pick up, or imagine, or taste, or feel, or think, that isn't demonstrating or exhibiting itself as changing. All is impermanent. All is shifting and changing to the degree that we don't even find impermanence. Why? Because there isn't anything within experience persisting long enough to be impermanent. This is the real meaning of what impermanence is. These are profound thoughts and pointings, we would say. There's nothing here for you to grip. I don't expect you to believe anything I'm saying. But what we do in the way the Buddha taught was just simply to point out these things for us and to notice what is actually taking place from moment to moment within experience. And with that, we don't really find things. We do find the appearance of things, the appearance of self, me, or you, and we live accordingly with that. But the idea that there's actually some substantial thing behind any of these terms, that we can see, doesn't show us any kind of substantiality there or any kind of persistence. Or again, as I was saying, if you look very carefully at that word, existence, we don't find that. Existence has to mean, and I'm sure it does in your mind, if you dig into it deep enough and look at it, stare at it long enough, you realize you're assuming persistence. We just simply don't find that. And so it is with this, then, waking up to this, that the Buddha found the path to the release from suffering. And basically, what that comes down to is the relinquishment of views, of ideas, beliefs, thinking that such and such is true. Truth, reality, doesn't go into a conceptual form. It doesn't go into an idea or a belief or anything of this sort. And to the extent that we allow ourselves to be captured by this sort of thing, this is the basis of suffering and confusion in human life. And this is what the Buddha pointed out. I was reluctant to speak on this point because I realized I couldn't talk about this word presence, I don't think, without getting into the deeper aspects of this teaching. And I hope it isn't too much. Normally I don't jump in front of even students who've been with me a while point out things at this level of subtlety. So I hope I didn't scare you or or made this too difficult. And I hope I also didn't make it sound kind of crazy, because it can sound crazy. But the way we find this is not to take hold of an idea I may have given you. I don't mean to really give you any ideas here, but to have you just kind of notice something about your experience. And what the Zen practice is, and Buddhist practice in general, that we all follow some form of meditation generally, but it is just simply to sit down, quiet the mind, and carefully observe what is actually being experienced from moment to moment. And we will realize that there is no permanence in any of this. This is why we're alive. This is what life is. This is constant coming up for something new, fresh, now. But it's always now. In an instant, it's already, that's past. But we'll hang on to that as it goes. Maybe wanting to get it back or getting back to some conditions that were working at the time when that happy moment was there. But we're ignoring where we actually are living out this reality, which is right now. And so those are views that we might hold about the past. Fear of the future, or maybe great hope for the future, whatever. Which maybe can be fulfilled in some limited way, but it won't be the future we ever imagined. But it's still something that isn't here. There's not too much you can do about that. To the extent you can do anything about that, you just take care of it in this moment. But in this moment, the taking care of this moment is simply just being here without it making anything of it and just attending to this moment as completely and fully as we can. Then we can live out our life, not as ourselves, but as this whole unfolding of reality itself. Because that's what's being lived out. It's not in the past, it's not in the future, it's not in the ideas we construct in our minds, or in our hopes and dreams. It is just simply right here. And to the extent that we can let go of our views, drop our views, our understandings, our conceptual understandings of things, then the full understanding of what is actually being lived out. That's what's left. That's what the understanding then becomes. This is awakening, the awakening that the Buddha found. And with this comes not so much the end of suffering in the sense that you'll never stub your toe or lose a loved one or whatever. It's not that, but that it is knowing that to live completely out of this moment, we can take care of that. We're not forming ourselves into something that's being crushed by this moment or driven in some way by this moment. We can just live it out completely and fully. And the world itself in totality is at peace. It is very, very quiet, very settled, and we can learn to live in just this way. I don't know how long, there's a reflection on the clock, so I can't see how long I've been talking. But any questions about anything I've said? Yes.
Hi, Steve. I've had the pleasure of hearing you speak many times when I was a Dharma before that. And I think one of the things that was so impactful to me,
can you speak a little bit, briefly maybe, of grasping and the story of the moon? Because I feel like that really ties into...
Are you talking about the story of the two moons?
Just noticing the moon.
Oh, okay. Okay, I think I did. Yeah, there's a lot of moon stories, but... I think maybe you mean... the Buddha pointed this out, that this teaching is like the moon. In fact, in Zen, the full moon is a metaphor for enlightenment. And so he offers teachings that point to the moon, point it out for us. It's like we could take our finger and point at the moon. So the teaching, the Buddha likened his teaching to something like that, that he can't actually give us enlightenment. He can't give us the moon. And of course, in his day, we've never even the idea of getting to the moon, you know, was totally, so it's like something that's quite visible, noticeable, and yet we can't really reach it in some physical kind of way or touch it. But we can see it. We can realize it and know it, and know it in a most complete way, not through an intellectual or a conceptual knowing, which is inadequate, but through a visceral, direct knowing, realizing it as something not separate from self. And that's why we don't find self separate from anything at all. It's really totality. So that's what that teaching, what he's doing there. And he's saying that, you know, we'll point to the moon, but it's like pointing out the moon to a dog or a cat, you know, and they'll just come up and sniff your finger. So, you know, and they don't quite catch that, let's draw your attention toward that which we can't really grasp or touch. But we can see and realize. So that's what's in that particular teaching. So Buddhism is not... There are Buddhists who believe certain things and that kind of thing, but and that might be, maybe that's Buddhism. But Buddha Dharma, which is what Western people gave Buddha Dharma the term Buddhism, but it's not really originally part of the term. It is simply Buddha Dharma, Buddha meaning, in the case applied to a human, be an awakened one, a Buddha, but it's just enlightenment, and Dharma is teaching. And so the teaching of the awakened, those who fully awaken to the true nature of this reality that we're living out, that's what they say, what they teach is called Buddha Dharma. But that image I was using of, you know, pointing to the moon, then that would be like Buddha Dharma. It doesn't give us something to grip. It doesn't give us something to believe, to take hold of this idea, well, this is true and that is not true. We never speak in these terms. People will hear it that way because we're used to putting everything into dualistic terms. And this is good and that is bad. And, you know, keep looking at it. Under some different circumstances, this could change radically from this frozen way that we pick up the world and cage it up in our minds with various aspects, maybe fighting or dueling it out, you know, even within our own minds, let alone between other people and in the world. So this is this teaching then is not trying to tell us to think this or to think that or believe this or believe that or no, that one's wrong and this one's better. We just simply don't do this. It's just simply a matter of pointing out, just kind of pointing directly toward what is actually being experienced moment by moment. And it leaves it for each of us to see for you. You look at that, you examine that. That's what the Buddha said on his deathbed. He said, you know, you're given this teaching. He said, this is for you to see for yourself, to see and know for yourself what is true and what is real. One thing you want to be looking for, though, in your own mind, again, this is all mental, it's always the mind. Look into your own mind and see if you're assuming something here, if you're holding something, particularly if you're thinking something is better than this other thing over here. Just keep looking at it. And these kinds of distinctions will begin to dissolve. Then if you want to reach some kind of, it would be compromise if they were truly separate, but you want to find a full completion of that so we can live in peace and harmony, because the whole does live in peace and harmony. It's our minds, in our own minds, we have to find that. But we cannot find that if we keep gripping views or beliefs or holding one thing separate from another. That inevitably is going to lead to conflict. And as soon as you see this, even within your own mind, don't fight that. That's what's coming up. But notice it and realize the implications of that and the bearing it might have on your behavior or your speech or any number of things, how you interact with others and that sort of thing. So this is not about gripping anything of any kind. It's about relinquishing views. That great teacher I mentioned, Nagarjuna, at the end of his great masterwork, the Mulamajamaka Krika, he said in this final verse, he said, I bow to Gautama, the man, not the Buddha, Shakyamuni, but Gautama, you know, the greatest of all teachers, he said, who taught us the relinquishment of views. And ultimately, that is what these enlightened teachings bring us to. Just notice what you're doing when you're hanging on to one idea or another. You're insisting on pushing this through or pushing that through. It doesn't mean to offer ideas, things like this, but don't own it too tightly. Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's been wonderful to talk with you. Thanks.